Everybody okay? Good. You taping right now? All right.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Works presents Earth on the Air.
During the next 30 minutes, Earth on the Air's grassroots contributors explore some of the issues and debates associated with animal rights.
It's an emotional battlefield that's been heating up in recent years and promises to get even hotter.
A philosophy professor takes on a veterinarian in a probing personal debate.
Visit SeaWorld. Is it a prison for marine mammals or a park for the benefit of all?
Meet Ivan the Gorilla, on display at a shopping center for the pleasure of Tacoma, Washington shoppers.
And more. First, here's a sound essay contributed by Peter Young, an independent audio artist.
Do animals have rights?
To a certain extent. I feel that people are more important than animals.
I think they do, because a lot of times that they can't stand up for themselves, they can't, you know, speak out.
I mean, they've been here just as long as humans have.
God put them on this earth just as much as us, so, you know, they have just as much right to this world as we do.
I think that humans should be equal to fleas, to horses, to Zen masters.
And they're constantly talking about the inhumane act to the poor little wee beastie.
It's no longer the old farm where the animals are out in the pasture, living in the sunlight and grazing, and then are killed right there on the farm. What we have now are huge agribusiness concerns that keep animals in intensive confinement.
I don't feel that a starving dog should take preference over a starving human being.
The higher the developed the animal, the more it should have to look over the lower developed animals.
What do you think are rights?
Freedom to live in a clean nature.
Constitution says we have certain rights. And maybe that's as far as it gets spelled out. Do the animals have a constitution?
When we take animals and we cage them up and we force feed them and we deprive them from sunlight and that sort of thing to create veal, that's abusive. I don't know if I would use the term rights, but I would say that's abusive.
Humanity taking over, isn't that amazing? Isn't that outrageously arrogant? And here we are, and we've got this one little teeny little speck of life in the universe. An outrageous, precious gem as it is, and humanity decides to create abuse. Isn't that outrageously arrogant and embarrassing? Isn't it embarrassing?
Personally, I think the abusive behavior toward animals has to stop, as well as the other abusive things that we've been doing as a culture toward nature and toward ourselves. You know, it's going to get us in the end anyway, whether we like it or not. It's going to make us stop.
My name is Paul Kinsey. I'm a philosopher at Towson State University in Towson, Maryland. I recently found out that from 1932 until 1972, certain African-American men in Macon County, Alabama, were denied treatment for syphilis. Investigators wanted to observe the progress of the disease. Today we are repelled by this. Today we use animals. Now, I know that this comparison between persons and animals is likely to rile some people, but the problem sticks in my mind. How do we draw the line between beings which we can use for our purposes and beings which we cannot? I wanted to talk to someone who has had to draw these lines in practice. I invited John Strandberg, a veterinarian and head of comparative medicine at the Johns Hopkins Medical School, to talk with me and some other philosophers.
Well, from my own personal philosophy, which is obviously has a significant religious basis, I think that humans and animals are basically different.
Not just different in intelligence, says Strandberg. He would not experiment on retarded humans, for example, at least partly because he sees a spiritual difference. I ask this scientist whether that difference is an immortal soul.
If you would never do the experiment on the lower strata of persons, What is it that distinguishes them morally from the non-human animals on whom you would do the experiments? It is this presence of an immortal soul.
Essentially.
If you gave up your religious beliefs, then would this become a more troubling issue for you? Or
I think it would certainly it would make it more difficult to say where does one draw a line.
At the mention of the soul, Lou Coleman's ears pricked up.
I'm interested in this, I think, because I consider myself a devout Christian. I'm not sure what having a soul means. I have a 2-year-old granddaughter. Mm-hmm. It's my first grandchild. And she's so superior to every other child that's ever been born.
Right.
And I know I'm right about that because her parents agree and her other grandparents and her aunts and uncles. You know, I might, since she is so special, I might make an argument that, well, she, if there's an argument with another 2-year-old, she has the right to dominate the other one and so forth. But I also know I'd have trouble convincing grandmothers of other 2-year-olds of my granddaughter's superiority.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that my emotional commitment is something that's out there as some kind of moral principle.
That's right. No, I think if we let our emotions govern our moral principles, we are in
serious
problems.
Well, but I think that's what we're doing when we're saying that human beings are
I disagree with that. No,
So tell me what's, I mean, it's like everybody else knows the difference and I don't and I can't figure it out. What is the difference? And you said soul, but that doesn't mean anything to me. I mean, what?
Well, I'm a speciesist then. It's the species. Let's put it that way.
Well, okay, right. And I am too.
Well, so that's why we're here. And that's why our pets aren't here talking about this situation.
Dr. Strandberg does think we can look at other features of beings, features less supernatural than the soul, in making distinctions about the rights of animals.
The rights of animals are somewhat in proportion to the degree of sensation or appreciation that the animal may possess. For instance, I think the rights that a non-human primate has would exceed those of a snail.
Now, I'm not really sure that I feel more pain than a lab rat does. So, if we go by sensation, it's just possible that much experimental use of animals will be ruled out. But Strandberg, at least in general, does not rule out the use. This, I think, brings us back to the soul, Strandberg's intrinsic difference between humans and animals.
My view is that animals are different from people, and that we, as people, have the ability and the right to use animals, but we must use them in a responsible way, and that we can use them for food, we can use them for enjoyment, for just for observing them.
When we use them in these ways, what test applies?
To do as little harm as possible, but that to not to rule out using them.
There is another consideration which is not supernatural and which I'm beginning to think may be the really central one.
I think humans have a special place in that humans have demonstrated that they have a special place by asserting it. No other species has done that.
I've sometimes thought, what would happen if some superior creature from another planet came here and looked at what humans are doing to the Earth and decide that humans should be wiped out? What kind of argument could we present against that?
Well, I think given the we could probably present a very poor argument.
This kind of thing has also been said about particular races. Races that have developed certain styles of civilization have felt that this justified them in using for their own purposes members of other races.
Yes, they have, but in fact, if one tries to say where does this... what is the difference between this race and the other race? It becomes a very difficult situation, and you can't separate them that way. It becomes a... Whereas you can separate species.
When you addressed Lou's question about a species superior to us using us for experiments, you said we could probably answer their reasoning only very poorly.
Well, I'm not sure that... I find it a question that... It doesn't have any relevance to me, frankly. Whatever this super crowd is that's going to do this stuff, well, they're going to do it. And there may be a new logic system. Fine.
It seems a very odd answer to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, from my I can't identify with that perspective insofar, and in just the same way, I don't think that an animal can identify with my perspective.
But you can indeed entertain the thought, can't you, that there would be a species more intelligent than human beings?
Sure.
And so then the question would arise, what use they would be permitted to make of us?
Well, since they are the ones who are, in fact, defining the moral order, as in fact we are the ones who are defining the moral order here, I don't think that we have a say in it, and we would do whatever they said. We would hope that their view would be sympathetic to ours, in just the same way that non-human animals hope that we have the similar sort of perspective that that they do.
I have read...
I'm way over my head when we get into... You've got me a long way from veterinary medicine here.
Well, we can go. We can.
And there, perhaps, the discussion rests. I do not want to say that Dr. Strandberg feels no empathy for animals. In fact, I think that is false. But I do worry that if we merely assert a special place, our empathy is arbitrarily cut off. Isn't this what happened with the African-American men used in the syphilis experiment in Macon County, Alabama? Will our empathy ever be more widely and less arbitrarily extended? That remains to be seen.
The B&I department store in Tacoma, Washington. Owners call it the circus store. There are clowns, arcade games, a merry-go-round, and in the back of the store, past the clothing and sundries, there's a large room filled with caged animals. The main attraction, a 425-pound silverback gorilla named Ivan. Producer Winona Wilson paid B&I a visit and brought back these impressions.
Captured at the age of 6 months from what was formerly the Belgian Congo, Ivan has been at the B&I for over 25 years. His quarters are mostly bare. There's a climbing structure, a tire swing. Sometimes he's able to watch TV. The concrete walls are decorated with crudely painted plants. A soundproof plexiglass partition separates Ivan from curious shoppers. I wondered whether passersby found the place as depressing as I did, so I asked onlookers what they thought of Ivan's situation.
Well, I think he's getting the best that he's going to get as far as being here. They treat him well and feed him well. But I think that, like anything else, he's, you know, flesh and blood and has a brain.
Well, he must like it. He ain't killed nobody yet. But if it was me, I'd hate it because he's locked up.
Do you think Ivan has any rights?
Well, yeah, he should have rights. I mean, he's a critter, you know.
I don't think he has any greater right than the McDonald's cheeseburger that you eat. What's the difference? He's an animal.
Not everyone is so unsympathetic. For several years now, activists have been lobbying for Ivan's release. The Progressive Animal Welfare Society, PAWS, has been a driving force behind these efforts. I spoke with PAWS's Mitchell Fox about Ivan's plight.
If you're at all concerned about the exploitation of animals, you're sickened by the casual and trivial demeaning use of animals at the B&I department store, and Ivan being such a charismatic megavertebrate kind of brings the point home more than some of the other animals in equally insufficient caging there at the B&I. But it's really all a throwback to their glory days back in the 1940s and 50s, when there used to be a variation of a pinball machine with a live chicken in it. I think it was called Bird Brain, and you'd put a quarter in and this chicken feed would come out, and the chicken would in effect run the bases while you'd watch.
I asked Mitchell Fox if it could be said that animals like Ivan have rights.
Rights. He's got some rights under the Animal Welfare Act. But the Animal Welfare Act is mainly concerned with housekeeping, not why he's kept, but how he's kept. Really, he's one man's property, and society is able to do whatever they went with Ivan, basically, I would turn it around and say, what moral obligations, not what legal rights does Ivan have, but what obligations do we have to see that he's not exploited? And he's not a mere marketing tool for an entrepreneur from Tacoma.
The fate of Ivan lies in the hands of one man, Ron Irwin. Irwin, whose parents founded the BNI in 1946, is currently its vice president. The Progressive Animal Welfare Society has been effective in mobilizing public opinion. Thousands of people in the Tacoma area have signed a petition calling for Ivan's release. Protesters are a common sight at the store. On this particular afternoon, two people carry signs urging a boycott of the store.
I'm angry about it, going all the way back to how they obtained him. And a lot of people don't realize that, you know, the great white hunters went over there and shot his mother to death and stole him as an infant and his little sister. The little sister didn't last but just a couple of weeks or a month or something before she died of neglect. And this is what's left. And this was, you know, the Department of Agriculture authorized this. It was okay to do this. And that's unacceptable that they would allow this to go on.
I think that Ron, a businessman, Ivan is like the least of his concerns in a business workday world. And as I told Ron, this is why I'm out here every Saturday, is to remind him to keep thinking about Ivan, that he needs to get out of here. His time is running out.
I tried to reach Ron Irwin for his side of this story, but he did not return my calls. Local newspapers report that Irwin has turned down offers from two zoos with special gorilla habitats, that currently he's considering an offer from superstar Michael Jackson, who's indicated he wants to purchase Ivan for his private reserve in Santa Barbara, California. In the meantime, Ivan languishes behind the plexiglass walls of his dark cage. His eyes look vacant as he sits listlessly on the concrete floor.
Gentlemen, please say hello to Cindy and Sandy.
A dolphin show at SeaWorld of Florida. In the summer of 1991, someone claiming to be an employee of SeaWorld circulated an unsigned letter to animal rights groups. The owners of SeaWorld, the letter reads, referring to the Bush Entertainment Corporation, have refused to listen to the people that really know what is needed to care for the animals. The killer whales need more space, more pools, and better medical facilities. The only male we have is in the Texas park, and the animal doesn't do well there. He beats his head on the gates and wells. It's a lousy design and doesn't provide enough space for such a big animal. All the owners care about is the profit line. They give the impression that if an animal dies, don't worry about it. We will find some place to buy more. The sentiments of this letter are corroborated and expanded upon by a number of former park employees around the country who have made it their mission to speak out. The following interviews were sent in by Florida actor Bill George, who wanted to find out what good the parks do. But first he spoke with several people who used to train marine mammals at another Florida ocean park.
My name is Russ Rector. I'm with the Dolphin Freedom Foundation. I was a trainer from 1968 to 1975 at Ocean World. Worked with dolphins and seals and sea lions.
My name is Brett Decker. I worked for Ocean World 3 years as a diver trainer and did an underwater dive show with the dolphins every day.
These oceanariums say, well, we have to keep these animals here so that you can appreciate them and learn from them and see how they are in the wild. That's like saying you're going to go to an insane asylum, view the inmates, and make your determination on human society from viewing the inmates.
They just don't receive enough care or attention. You can't give them enough time and love to substitute for what you've taken away from them by ripping them away from their pod out in the wild.
Basically, captive dolphins and orcas display captive-related stress in three ways. One is deviant sexual behavior. Another one is aggression. They get very aggressive toward humans and other animals. And then the third is depression. They die from pneumonia, hepatitis, septicemia. Respiratory diseases are a big killer. Ulcers are a big killer of animals in captivity. They develop stress-related ulcers. Also, dolphins can commit suicide. They can just decide not to take the next breath. You know, if you believe in oceanarium, dolphins have so much fun at these oceanariums, they're stacked up at the back gate waiting for the next job opening. And nothing could be further from the truth. They go out and they tear these animals away from their families. They physically wrestle them into exhaustion and drag them kicking and screaming back into these oceanariums, these dolphin abusement centers.
As you can see, Shadow is just kind of swimming around the pool here. We're going to give him a few minutes until he gives us maybe some type of little signal here to where he would be interested in going up into our side pool. If he does not do that, basically what we're going to do, we have to go on with the show, ladies and gentlemen. So we're going to.
It was the show must go on mentality. It's show business. It's, you know, the trainers are all smiling and happy. The animals are all happy. Of course, dolphins have that permanent smile on their face. Regardless of how the animal was feeling or behaving, it had to perform in a show. This is four times a day, 365 days a year.
When animals do something incorrect here at SeaWorld, basically we give them absolutely nothing, no attention.
You got to understand, a full dolphin won't perform. If a dolphin has all it wants to eat, it's not going to work. So you constantly have to keep them hungry. You, I can control you. I can get you to do anything I want you to do if I can control your food. I can make you do things you never thought you would ever do.
Animals had different problems in their lives, illnesses, stillbirths, fights with other dolphins. Basically, the solution to that always was cut back their food, starve them if you have to, get them to perform. Just get them to do something.
Yes, the animals do receive food when they do something correct, but they also receive other things. Basically, they can receive play toys.
And a lot of trainers get embarrassed when the animals don't perform. An animal screws you over in a show, you're going to get even with it later on when the public's not around. That's one of those dirty little secrets of the dolphin training business that they don't want the public to know about.
They do seem very happy now. You know, this love-hate relationship that we have here at SeaWorld with our animals sometimes that says, I want to be with you now, but when you try to take one away, no, you can't do that. I want to be with you now. And it's exactly seems like what we're seeing right here and now.
There's no benefits coming out of it for those animals whatsoever. And I would really like to see some evidence of any research that has been done at these parks that have benefited these animals in the wild. There is none. The education, they're teaching people that humans are the masters of the earth and the animals are here for us to pluck and do with what we, you know, pluck from the wild and do what we want with them.
Some ocean parks, like SeaWorld, do more than showcase marine animals. In fact, SeaWorld has the largest facility in Florida authorized to rescue, care for, and then release endangered manatees, sea cows, who get trapped, orphaned, injured, or sick. After 6 years of rehabilitation, a West Indian manatee is released into the Indian River.
Two, three.
It's the 27th manatee rescued and then released by SeaWorld staff. Park staff also respond to calls to aid seals, dolphins, whales, otters, turtles, and birds. SeaWorld also has a research department that studies the health and environmental concerns of marine animals. The department is headed by Dr. Dan O'Dell, who received a Point of Light Award from President Bush for his work.
We've had good success here. One of the orphans, whose name is Charlotte, she's in here someplace, she's about 6 years old now, and she had a calf last August, or October, excuse me. But it's a nice comparison with a calf that's being raised normally versus the orphans that were hand-rearing. Charlotte is an example of an orphan. She came in, she was a couple of weeks old. So we now have a sort of a bottom line at age at sexual maturity on an orphan female. We know that they can come in as orphans, that they can grow up and successfully reproduce. This is important for us to know when we release animals, to know that they can, in fact, not only readapt, as they do very easily, to the natural environment, but go out and reproduce. That's really the key thing of getting them back in there so that they can contribute to the population.
Now, if you're wondering what these research and rescue efforts have to do with the issue of capturing and showcasing animals, the answer, for the most part, is money.
All of the research, the operations done here at SeaWorld, are funded by the guests that come through the front gate. The manatee program in itself literally costs hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and that's paid for by the people that come in through the front gate.
Former trainer Russ Rector says he doesn't have a complaint against rescue operations like those at SeaWorld.
Well, anytime you rescue any type of injured animal and nurse it back to health, that's a positive thing. But the atrocities that these oceanariums commit on the other marine mammals totally overshadows anything that they do with rescuing a few manatees. It doesn't equate to rescue a few manatees yet kill 107 dolphins at SeaWorld. That's not an equal trade-off.
When Rector speaks of killing dolphins, he's referring to studies that indicate marine mammals tend to die prematurely when in captivity. But SeaWorld claims there is no scientific consensus on the matter, that more studies are needed.
We see the same illnesses in the wild that we see here in the park.
Furthermore, SeaWorld veterinarian Mike Walsh says the animals get state-of-the-art care.
In relation to animals that are used for show purposes or educational purposes, if they become ill, they're basically retired until they're given a clean bill of health to come back.
What do most animals die in captivity of?
Animals such as in a park situation die from the same things they die from in the wild, other than predation and parasites. Most of them die eventually from old age.
And psychologically, are their behaviors any different here?
For the most part, the way the animals behave in a setting such as a zoological park or aquarium is not that much different, especially if you've gone to the effort, such as a place the SeaWorld does, to maintain the population similar to the way they maintain it in the wild.
As more data are collected to confirm or refute SeaWorld's position, there seems to be a growing public perception that keeping marine mammals in captivity is not a good thing. Recently, South Carolina became the first state to ban marine parks entirely. Dozens of ocean theme parks have already closed down in British Columbia, Great Britain, and Australia. Meanwhile, the U.S. Marine Mammal Protection Act explicitly encourages the public display of dolphins under the theory that public familiarity with the creatures will encourage their protection.
If you were a dolphin, would you want to live here or would you want to live in the wild?
No, I think I would like to live here. Seems like they love it.
They look like they enjoy themselves here, but yeah, I think for them it'd be better off in the wild.
They're too beautiful to be confined.
Do you want to live here or would you want to live in the wild?
Probably here, because of the care that you get from the members of SeaWorld.
I'm not one for seeing them in that kind of condition. I'd rather see them in their natural habitat out in the wild.
Because I think that they're just as valuable as a human. They should have their freedom just like we do.
That's the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Don't forget, this is your program, too. We invite you to take part in Earth on the Air's ongoing radio dialogue.
Find out about becoming a member of the Earth on the Air Radio Works and receive a copy of our submission guidelines.
Write us at P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
Earth on the Air Submissions Director is Susan Gleason. Our Executive Director is Craig McDonald. The show is produced and edited by Peter Mulloff and Suzanne Tedesco, and engineered by Scott Bergen.
We had help from Jean-Paul Bardou, Lowell Harvey, Scott Kirk, Ted Gates, and Aaron Harridge.
Also thanks to People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, KUOW, and the Dub Train Cassette Duplicating Services in Seattle.
The sounds from the manatee rescue operation were used with permission from SeaWorld of Florida.
Music was by Roland Barker, David Hines, and Randy.
Production facilities provided by KSER in Linwood, Washington.
Partial funding was from the Town Creek Foundation, Resist, and the Mary Reynolds Babcock Foundation.
If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-800-3145. Mention that you'd like program number 22. For the Earth on the Air Radio Works, this is Peter Mulloff.
And I'm Janice Kane.